From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 12th day of October 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. We'll take a look at the weather forecast with Mark Russo. Frayne Olson of North Dakota State University will be here to talk about the P&W and soybean exports. He says, yeah, those are real. And we'll also discuss this morning's economic sciences announcement from the Nobel Prize Committee on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
December corn for the day down 6, finished at 389, the March at 396 and 3 quarters, 5 and a half lower in July, down 5 and 3 quarters at 403 and 3 quarters. November beans 31 and 3 quarters lower. Settlement price there at $10.33 and 3 quarters. January 10.36 and 3 quarters down 29. And July at 10.28 and a quarter 17 lower. Bean oil off a dollar and a penny. Bean meal $6.40 lower. Wheat futures July soft red up a half, 5.94 and 3 quarters the settlement price. And hard red at 5.51 down 3 and 3 quarters of a cent. Live cattle futures October down about 52.5. Feeders were down 95 cents and lean hogs. In the lead were up a nickel, but December was down 50 cents to settle at $66.62.5. We're now joined by Kurt Kimmel at Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. What happened in Chicago today?
Well, we saw some profit-taking, liquidation. It's the holiday that is a major benchmark to the history here. Flat Earth Day, I guess you call it now, but Columbus Day holiday. There was no real government reports or updates, and the trade was eager looking for some export sales to be announced, and that won't materialize until tomorrow. Also, too, harvest activity will be tomorrow. Then to couple that, we had some rains in the forecast for Brazil. So it kind of took the bullish edge off and put the market in a position here to see some type of correction. Commodity funds were sellers on the day. Going into midday, they were sellers of 20,000 contracts of corn. I mean, 20,000 contracts of beans, about 12,000 contracts of corn. The significance of this holiday goes way, way back. In fact, Paul Bates had a friend in Chicago, Sherman Levine, who said that gentlemen don't trade the short side of the market after Columbus Day. And he's mainly from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We usually had fall lows in by then. Then that terminology moved into the pick and roll, and most people remember the Columbus Day holiday from the fact that LDP days, you were able to take advantage of the marketplace. It was kind of a free spin, like on a Wheel of Fortune. When you had the Friday's numbers and you come in Monday without the government being open, if there was a dramatic move, particularly upward, you could take advantage and do some LDP activity. So this day is a historic day, along with Thanksgiving Day in Canada. So a little bit of history there, and it's kind of a benchmark now. The way the market reacted here today, particularly in corn, making a new high and close lower, we're probably set up here to back and fill here for a little bit. Harvest progress tomorrow. Man, these beans just came out fairly slick here in the last week. A week ago, we saw a bean harvest at 38%. I imagine bean harvest as a nation is close to about 70% complete. There's some later beans still maturing and dropping leaves. The biggest bean harvest week we've seen gain-wise was anywhere from 21 to 32% in 1 week, bean harvest. And I imagine we're going to test that upper end, if not surpass it. Corn harvest is probably going to drag a little bit due to the guys being in the beans. Corn harvest last week was 25% complete, and I'd say we probably jumped about 10% there to 35% complete as a nation. And on the biggest corn harvest weeks here was back in 2013-14, where we saw corn harvest jump in 1 week anywhere from 18 to 20% in 1 week. So the machinery we have today and the excellent weather we saw would probably saw a pretty good harvest week. And I think the bean market reflected that here today, Todd. As you look back on the last couple weeks, November and January beans have gained on the back end, indicating we need beans now. And the bull spread represented that. But after Friday's report and the harvest activity we've seen, I think we've kind of filled up the pipeline Well, we saw the bullish break kind of lose its enthusiasm here, where now we're seeing the November, January beans lose ground to the deferred contracts.
Are the expectations that this will remain a volatile market for soybeans, particular for very long?
Oh, I think so. I think this thing is, I don't think we're entering the super cycle phase, but you can go back to the early 70s, and it's I was probably in grade school, and what happened was the question was beans went to $9 to $10, and it said, why don't you sell some beans at $9 to $10? Well, farmers said, well, I sold them at $5. Well, why'd you sell them at $5 for? Well, that's the highest price we've ever seen. Beans trade between $2 and $4 forever, and the thing just took off and never looked back. I don't know if we're in that type of phase, but back then it was international buying and a lot of things that are somewhat similar to today, but not much. So the thing is, when you look back on that, things like that can happen. But the thing is, when you look at that price action, it goes straight up and it comes straight down. So the bottom line is there's some volatility that's going to be there, and you got to have some type of plan or covered position because volatility is probably going to increase here from now until you're in.
Anything more before I let you go?
Just one other general observation on the beans. The computers sold July $10 puts, 2,500 contracts there. So if you look at the volume and the options, they sold July $10 puts and they sold May $10 puts fairly aggressively on the day. So I don't know if that's a signal that $10 is going to be support or not.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Very good. Take care.
That's Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Joined us here on the closing market report for this Monday afternoon. If you're in the field, be careful out there. Take some time for yourself. Get a little shut-eye. Take a nap in the afternoon because you're working really hard. And the safety specialist here on campus say that's one of the best things you can do to keep yourself at the top of your game. Also, if you have to be out and about, be sure that you're watching out for the farmers on those back roads. The vehicles are big. They move slow. Farmers are looking out for you. You look out for them, too. Well, the Nobel Committee today awarded the prize for economic sciences to a pair of Stanford University economists for their work in auction theory, particularly the work the two did to create a new kind of auction first used in 1994 by the U.S. government to auction off radio frequencies. Now, it's called simultaneous multiple round auction. There's deep basic economic sciences in the work leading up to the creation of this format. It packages together parcels in the ways a bidder might see as advantageous, but does not require them to acquire the whole parcel. And that sounded really familiar to me. Murray Wise of Murray Wise & Associates Land Auction Group right here in Champaign, Illinois, former owner of the Westchester Group, has been doing something similar in the land market for more than three decades. I took time this morning to call him to talk about it.
Todd, it's simply a system that we've developed over many, many years whereby we overdivide the property. And, you know, before the auction occurs, we're frequently criticized for, why did you divide that? Well, we overdivide it and we let the bidders put it back together in a way that makes sense to them, okay? And it's also a system whereby if an individual potential buyer, a bidder, is bidding on, let's say, five different tracks regarding our offering, they can watch the price of each of those five tracks individually. And if a given track gets to a price where they find, oh, that's too high for me, they can back up in our system and go back to four tracks, go back to three tracks. They can do anything they want. And that's why I sort of agree with those Stanford researchers on the basis that I believe if you give people flexibility, if you give people knowledge as to what they're bidding against, then they're liable to bid more on what they desperately want, or they're liable to eliminate something. Now, in my opinion, Todd, it's a really interesting process, and I'll be the first to say I believe in most cases it results in a modestly higher price for the individual property.
How long have you been doing this kind of work with the auctions that you run?
1987.
That's a long time.
That's a long time, Todd Gleason. You know, it's a way of unfortunately divulging my age.
Potentially. So I do have a question about it. Have you, over the years, perfected it in some form or found things that work better and or that don't work and that you've either added or eliminated from what you began with?
Todd, I'm embarrassed to disclose that over the years, we now have more than $500,000 invested in software to, in fact, accomplish this. Because as the years went by, you know, the first multi-parcel auction we did on was on an old Apple II, believe it or not, which also dates me, on the basis that, when you put in a request into that Apple II, it sat there and it bounced and it danced for about 5 minutes before it gave you the answer. Where today, we can have over $500,000 permutations. I believe we can have over $1 million permutations, meaning different ways that the property could sell. And we've constantly, and my own people are my best friends and my worst enemies all together on the basis they keep coming up. You know, if we could now do this, this system would even be better. Well, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 later, we changed the software one more time to accomplish the goals and objectives, and we're in the process of changing it one more time again, given respect to the COVID virus on these sales that we're doing where there's no live offering, particularly in Ohio, which we have a couple large auctions pending in Ohio. The Ohio governor, about 4 weeks ago today, reduced the number of people that you can have at a public event from 50 to 10, counting our own employees, which means that essentially eliminates the possibility of having a public auction. So in many cases today, we are doing everything online, which is, you know, a little more challenging and has required some updating to our software.
Do you have a name for the system?
We call it multi-parcel, meaning you can put any combination of parcels together that you, as the bidder, desire. And in the multi-parcel approach, we let you do whatever you want. We let you add a parcel later on. If it's something that you think is very reasonably priced and you'd like to have that parcel, you can add it in. Or if there's a parcel in your combination, meaning group of tracks that you're bidding on, that you want to eliminate, you can take that out at any time during the auction.
Is there a way that somebody who's just interested in watching this can find it on your website and see a live auction and what happens in the process of this multi-parcel auction?
I am not sure it's on our website, Todd, but anybody that wants to see an example of this, if they would email me at murray@mwallc.com, we have a sample auction. And it's actual, it's sound bites. It lasts for about 5 minutes. And it's sound bites from a large auction we did about 3 years ago over at Springfield, Illinois. And it's a really good demonstration, Todd, of how the system works. And anybody that will email me, then I'll send you a copy so you really see the dynamics of you know, how this works. You see the dynamics of what those authors at the from Stanford, who received the Nobel Peace Prize, their theory, which I haven't read about, but from what I've heard, you'll see how their theory does in fact work. It's an example of you being able to sit there and watch what the other people are doing with you or against you, shall we say. And we'd be very happy to send that to anyone who would send us an email or drop us a telephone call. Again, murray@mwallc.com.
Hey, thank you so much, Murray.
Good to talk to you as always, Todd. Thank you so much. Bye now.
And our thanks go to Murray Wise of Murray Wise Associates. I spoke with him earlier today after learning that a pair of economists from Stanford University were awarded the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences for their auction theory. Frayne Olson now joins us from North Dakota State University. Thanks so much for being with us. You're an agricultural commodity specialist there, an economist. What'd you think of the Friday USDA reports?
Well, like everybody in the market, there were some unexpected surprises, and that's often what we get from USDA about this time of year, where the market has a certain set of expectations or ideas about what they think is going to happen, and when USDA releases the numbers, those numbers are a little bit different. So we did have some sparks. This time it happened to be on the plus side. at least from the farmer standpoint and from an upward movement of prices instead of a downward. I get a lot of comments from farmers that every time USDA comes up with some new numbers, it always pushes prices down, and they don't always remember times like this where the opposite happened. So it was kind of nice to see that we've had a readjustment now, and moving forward at least set some new expectations.
Well, let's start with some of those number changes. Corn, soybeans both were dropped in ending stocks, down some 336 million bushels for corn, around 170 million bushels for soybeans. How much does that change the perspective for you?
Well, for soybeans in particular, we're now getting to kind of stocks to use ratio levels, where if we take the ending stocks divided by our total needs and think of that ratio as kind of what margin for error do we have in our system in case there's a problem going into next year. Those numbers now are getting down to levels we haven't seen in quite a while. And when we get the stocks to use ratio, when that relationship gets very tight, we tend to see higher prices on average, but a lot more volatility. And I think for most farmers, they're recognizing that the soybean market has a lot more volatility in it now. So we tightened up our supply-demand conditions in soybeans quite a bit. We're now back to some levels that we haven't seen in quite a while. So as I look forward, I think soybeans is still going to be the most volatile. I think it still has some upward potential, but we're going to need some help from South America. And and there are some weather things happening in South America now as they begin their planting progress that I think farmers need to be watching as we move forward. On the corn side, we did tighten things up a bit on the corn side. And a lot of that was a kind of some, for both corn and soybeans, a lot of the tightening occurred in two pieces. Not only what happened in the old crop, when we looked at our ending stocks numbers from the last marketing year, our grain inventory numbers that we got at the end of September, but also now some adjustments on the production side for the 2020 crop. And for both corn and soybeans, it was really the planted and harvested acreage that came down a little bit more than what I think the trade was expecting. The yield forecast, the yield estimates were very similar to kind of average trade estimates, which was definitely within the range. But the surprise and kind of the bigger adjustment came in the planted and harvested acreage numbers. So we've tightened up the corn balance sheet. It's not dramatically tight yet. We still have some flexibility. The one thing I am concerned with price movement in corn is as prices start to move higher, it's going to start putting some economic pressure, some profitability pressure back on the ethanol industry. So even though our exports and export pace have been very strong up to this point in time, we're early in the season, but we're still got some really good export pace into the Chinese market. But as prices go higher, that also puts some additional pressure on the ethanol folks. And that is one of the areas where I'm a little bit concerned, not only because of the economic downturn and some of the issues with coronavirus, but just longer-term profitability. Our oil consumption, gasoline prices are lower. And in my view, it's going to put kind of an upper cap on how much of a rally we can get out of corn without causing some additional demand issues.
Is there evidence going to the PNW that soybeans are going to be shipped?
Yes, there is. When we look at local basis levels, at least here in the Northern Plains, and again, in my region, when we get into North Dakota and parts of northern Minnesota, our export market, I mean, our dominant market is the PNW. And about 95 to 97% of the soybeans leaving PNW go directly to China. So we are very directly tied into that pipeline. And our basis levels, our local basis levels, are very strong right now, given the time of year. I mean, we obviously don't have the kind of basis levels you do in the central corn belt. But when we look historically at what we normally see at a harvest time period, we're looking typically at $1 to $1.10 under. A lot of elevators right now are at 60 to 70 under, which is a very strong basis at harvest. Even in the futures market, there's really no carry in the market right now. The futures market is really screaming at farmers saying, look, we need the beans now. We're not going to provide any kind of incentive for you to try and store into the future. So the movements into the PNW with the buildup of export sales into the Chinese market are real. I know there's some questions about whether all of those will actually be delivered. In my assessment, and when we look at the underlying demand that's coming out of the Chinese market, I do think the vast majority of those are going to be fulfilled. And we're seeing that in the cash market. So basis levels locally are very good. Our rail transportation, the movement of grain out of the area has been very smooth so far this time of year. So right now we're kind of hitting on all cylinders, which is kind of a good thing to see. We haven't seen that in several years.
Hey, thanks so much.
Yeah.
That's Frayne Olson. He's with North Dakota State University in Fargo, serves as an agricultural economist there. Now let's turn our attention to the weather forecast. Mark Russo is here from Risk Pulse in Chicago. Good afternoon to you, Mark. Let's start with today, because there has been a little rainfall, or at least I think there'll be a little rainfall in parts of the Corn Belt. Can you tell me about that and then what happens the rest of the week?
Sure, Todd. Yeah, looking at today with this rain system moving across the Midwest, it is a fast-moving system and not anticipating any kind of significantly heavy rainfall here. So overall, just some minor delays in harvest progress here today. But after that, things do look to dry back out again. And overall, it continues to look like the pattern across the Midwest will continue to feature below normal rainfall, maybe not quite as dry as the past couple of weeks, but still no sign of any turn to a wet pattern that would begin to bog things down.
Their temperatures will feel more fall-like?
They certainly will, especially coming up the latter portion of this week and on into the weekend, where it does look like temperatures will be dropping down to levels of 9, 10, even 12 degrees colder than normal. That will result in more widespread freezes here coming up, especially across the northern sections of the Midwest.
Are we still concerned about dry conditions in the hard red winter plains areas?
We certainly are, Todd. And the plains hard red belt will continue to be in a drier than normal pattern for the next few weeks. Also, a warmer temperature bias, especially the next 5 days, a little bit of variability after that. But even with the temperature variability, still no sign of any significant rain events there. So that remains an area of concern, an area to watch closely.
Your assessment of the growing areas in South America?
Well, over the next couple of weeks, South America is in a net improving mode in terms of rainfall. That's going to be especially true across Brazil, where we are now beginning to see the development of storm activity across areas of Mato Grosso and Center West. That's going to continue to expand with higher rainfall totals with time, and that will continue to improve soil moisture, initiate more crop planting, and allow for overall improvement in conditions there. In Argentina, there is going to be a rain event early next week that will provide some relief, but we do not see that as being the start of a more active pattern, but rather more of a one-shot deal before then dry weather returns to the region. So while all of South America will be in a net improving mode, at least once we get to month's end, we think still got to keep an eye on Argentina going through November due to likely still drier than normal condition.
Hey, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Todd.
Mark Russo is with Risk Pulse in Chicago, Illinois. Joined us on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. It comes to you from Illinois Public Media.